Hello and welcome. My name is John August.
No. My name is Craig Mazin.
And this is episode 742 of Script Notes. It's a podcast about screenwriting and things that are interesting to screenwriters. Today on the show, we welcome the writer-director of one of my favorite films of the summer, which has become a surprise blockbuster and the subject of countless articles.
A few think pieces here and there.
Yeah, positing, what does this mean for the future of Hollywood? So no pressure here.
No pressure at all.
The film is Obsession. The writer-director is Curry Barker. Welcome, Curry Barker.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So nice to have you here. I'm going to go a little further than you. Maybe it's my favorite movie of the year so far.
Wow, that's crazy.
It's not that long of a year. I don't know. I mean, like, it's not
absolutely.
That. But I mean, it's really good. It's really, really good. I just loved it.
Thank you.
Loved it.
That's so awesome to hear that.
Yeah.
So we want to talk about the movie. We want to talk about the process of getting it, but really sort of focus on the crafty things. As we said in sort of the warm-up, I'm sure you're sick of answering 1,000 questions about, like, the blockbuster of it all. And, like, the blockbuster is wonderful, but if this movie had made $5, it's still a really good movie that people should check out. And in our bonus segment for premium members, I want to focus on one of the most crucial things that no one is talking about in Hollywood.
Thank God.
It's not IMAX, it's not 3D, but it's a fundamental part of the cinematic experience these days, which is the popcorn bucket.
The novelty popcorn bucket. I saw it happening in your brain before you said it.
Yeah.
That's, you know why? Because we're close.
Yeah, that's what it is. We've done this for a few years. We have a sense.
Yeah, ever since the Dune popcorn bucket, it's just been a thing.
Yeah, it's a thing now.
It's a thing.
So we will focus in on what we want for our popcorn buckets for our films. Also, going back in time, like if we could sort of create the popcorn
bucket. The potential of the popcorn bucket back in the day.
Absolutely.
What was the Jaws popcorn bucket?
And how could it have been bad? Like what could have gone horribly wrong with a... I could definitely see an Exorcist popcorn bucket where it's just she's barfing the bucket. There's so many ways to go.
So in our bonus segment, we will dive
That's
deep
the last
into...
free popcorn bucket people get.
We will pick the last kernel out of that popcorn bucket. All right.
Okay.
But first, we have some follow-up that I promise tie into our discussion with Curry here.
Okay.
In episode 740, we talked about competence.
Yes.
It was a really good conversation.
Yes.
And we were centered around this blog post by Iris Meredith. And there was a word in there, which you and I had never heard of, ultra-crepidarian.
Ultra-crepidarian.
We didn't spend enough time on that, I think. So
okay.
You are a person who loves words.
I do.
Try to figure out ultra-crepidarian, what that might come from. It's Latin.
Well, obviously, ultra would mean beyond
or above. Crepida. Do you have any sense of crepida?
Crepida. Well, I'm trying to think of other words that have, so it's C-R-E-P.
Mm-hmm.
There's crepuscle. Mm-hmm. Which is a red blood cell.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's
connected. It's not.
That, maybe that's
I don't think
Greek.
We'll get there. It's sandal. So.
Oh, sure. I would not have gotten there.
It wouldn't have gotten there. So it's beyond the sandal, which is seems really strange. And so Iris actually wrote in, she listened to the episode and she wrote in, just tell us like where the origin of that is. And so apparently it comes from this painter named Apelles of Cos, who was getting criticism of how he painted sandals in his depictions of people and from sandal makers. And sandal makers are like, you painted that wrong. And so he's like, okay, well, I'll fix how I paint the sandals.
Yeah.
But then they started making notes about like the legs and other things.
Oh.
And he's like, no. You can focus on the sandals,
right.
But not above beyond
the sandals.
Yeah.
This is it. You've used it. There's a comic book artist is it Rob Liefeld? Who's sort of infamously bad at drawing feet.
Okay.
Or maybe he's really good at drawing feet. I can't remember. There's somebody who's like notoriously bad at feet.
Yeah.
It's like my characters always have shoes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why? It's in my contract. They have to have shoes.
Even in the shower.
Yeah.
The shoes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Ultra-crepidarian.
Ultra-crepidarian. So that's the origin of that word. And the segue I want to sort of make to is like with the success of Obsession, I feel like there's a lot of ultra-crepidarians weighing in here on sort of like, they're not just talking about like this little bit of knowledge that they actually understand, but they're trying to apply much more broadly to things beyond their actual scope of expertise. So it's nice to have the person who's actually the expert on making the film Obsession to talk about Obsession.
Itself. Right, right.
Yeah.
There you go.
This is better than a million think pieces about... Everyone's got a hot take.
Everyone's got a hot take.
But you know what? I will say that one of the things that I really loved about the work is that there is an elegance to it. The idea is not complicated.
No.
In fact, almost nothing about it is complicated. It's so simple and elegant, but it's so interestingly done.
Yeah.
That I think the reason, I'll do a think piece on think pieces, the reason there are 5 million think pieces is because it provokes an enormous amount of thought.
Right.
It gives you space. As somebody watching, to theorize and more importantly, put yourself in the shoes of the people that are involved.
Yeah.
And I found myself being both of them.
I think like I gravitate towards simple stories anyway. Like to me, people that would say, oh, this is such an idea that we've seen before or whatever. To me, like when I got excited about this idea, you know, 3 years ago, I wasn't excited about a Wish Gone Wrong movie. I was excited about the version that you saw. Mm-hmm. Like I was like, oh my God, I have this idea about this crazy movie. And even if you were just read the log line, you'd be like, oh, what? We've seen this a million times. I love stories that are simple because there's so much room.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes simple is just better. It's kind of like a magic trick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously the movie's been out for a while, so spoiler alert, but like Megan's death scene, right? Crazy. And
yeah.
But if that happened 4 times in the movie, then it's a slasher and it doesn't really work anymore.
Yeah.
But because it's all leading up to this kind of moment, why I say it's like a magic trick is it's like, gotcha. You know, it's like this movie is going there. And in a way that like a movie that does it a bunch of times, you would watch it and be like, well, the kills in this movie were just as crazy. So why was this one more effective? It's like just because it's more simple.
Well, you can't kill that character more than once because it's too good and important of a character.
Right.
The more you kill people, the less important they are and the more they are functionaries of plot.
Yeah.
It was wonderful how under the skin we got
yeah.
with everyone
right.
in the film.
So I do want to focus a lot on sort of the storytelling, but I want to give some sense of your storytelling here because I feel like a lot of our listeners can picture themselves in you in the sense of like a kid who grows up outside of Los Angeles, outside of New York, outside of the industry, moves here and figures out how to do stuff. So give us a sense of where you come from. So it's Mobile, Alabama.
Yeah, I'm from a small town in Mobile. Grew up, went to high school there at Baker. I was really involved. Like I didn't make good grades, but I was really involved. Like I was in
a lot of extracurriculars.
Yeah. I was in the acting program. I was in the band, mm-hmm. you know, the marching band. I was in BH1, which was like our news, mm-hmm. you know, where we actually got a lot of editing skills in BH1. And I went to acting competitions out in the States. You know, I was like constantly doing things, you know, I even started my own film club in school.
Well, classically, so you did a lot of the things you could do as a high school student, but it wasn't like there was a giant film community in Alabama. So we made Big Fish in Montgomery and like we had to hire everybody from every place else to sort of get up there. So,
yeah, I mean, it was non-existent really. And, you know, there is community theater out mm-hmm. there and it's actually like kind of a bigger thing. But if I wanted to act in film, I had to make it myself. And so I started really even editing and putting things together at a pretty young age. I think what I really got a sense for is my instincts of storytelling
mm-hmm.
kind of started growing at an earlier age that I think has really given me an advantage. I think there's a lot of instinct with storytelling sometimes, right?
No question. I mean, there's talent and mm-hmm. a lot of it is connected to that. What is interesting about somebody like you, especially now as people are coming to their own in their 20s and 30s, is that you do grow up with all the tools to make things, whereas we did not have those. A lot of times what started for us was writing. And the first interaction you have with whatever professional writing is you read a screenplay and you're like, this is what it looks like?
Right.
Okay. Can you talk about that aspect of it? Because there isn't a lot of practical instruction or do-it-yourselfishness to that.
Right. And what's really funny is I never would have saw myself as a writer. Like if a 12-year-old me were to look up and be like, to see me now and mm-hmm. see that I'm a professional writer, and I did air quotes for people that are just listening.
they were implied in the way you said
yeah, yeah, right. My 12-year-old self would just not believe. Be like, no, you're not. You're not good at English. You know, you're like English class and you don't understand grammar too well. And so it just didn't seem like it was in the cards for me to be a professional writer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really about storytelling and the human raw, like my bread and butter is kind of like conversation and like how it can get uncomfortable. And also like I learned a lot from, I did the Aaron Sorkin masterclass.
All right.
That was like a big
thing
for me.
Finally a masterclass paid off.
Yeah.
I've been waiting for one of these masterclasses to pay off.
Yeah.
Aaron Sorkin, we salute you.
So tell me about the Aaron Sorkin masterclass. So this is an online class where it's just like a simple lesson.
This podcast is brought to you by the Aaron Sorkin masterclass. We're not getting paid anything. This is outrageous.
So tell us about that.
This thing called Masterclass came out, right? And it's like this app you can download. And there's a director masterclass. There's all these masterclass. And I think when I moved out here, someone suggested, maybe it was even my dad, was like, you should do the Aaron Sorkin masterclass or something. And so I just started taking it. I learned so many rules about storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I kind of took it to heart in a way that probably really enhanced the way that the rules are so important. Like, you can't introduce something in the first act and then like not pay it off in the third act.
Right.
Or you can't like mm-hmm. have something magically appear in the third act that you didn't introduce in the first or second act, you know? It's yeah. like, or like, you can't have all the answers to the equation in the third act. And it does, like, all these things that like are kind of pretty important to make sure that you're either paying everything off or like yeah. not. That I could really give credit to the Aaron Sorkin masterclass.
Well, it's great because it feels like at some point you need, someone needs to sit you down and sort of tell you these kind of fundamental things, or at least point them out in ways that maybe you could have discovered over the course of years. But like, it's nice to have someone do that.
Yeah, and totally.
The great mystery and magic of it all is that you can, well, a lot of people have taken the Aaron Sorkin masterclass.
Right.
But I always feel like even with our podcast, we're really broadcasting to some group of people that will be able to convert.
Yeah.
Which is not everyone.
Right, right.
But you found it one way or the other. You found what you needed, understood it almost immediately. It was like right into your bones.
Yeah.
And then boom, out came something great.
It's an instinct thing, really. It's yeah. like you understand that if something doesn't feel right, it's probably because it wasn't paid off correctly. Or if something doesn't feel satisfying, or like what is it that you want to feel fully satisfied at the end? But then also the art of like knowing what doesn't need to be paid
yeah.
off, like what mm-hmm. doesn't need to like, and that's like really hard. Sometimes I just want to like ask other people, you know, like if I'm writing something,
sure.
like,
yeah.
does this matter to you? Like, you know,
or do
does
you?
It, right.
Did you ask people?
Yeah, is that part of your process?
Yeah. I mean, like, but the thing I learn is that you'll never get a answer.
There is no answer.
Yeah, that's the problem. <You know?
laughs> Here's another thing that's actually different about sort of how you learned versus how we learned is that you were making things constantly. And so talk to us about when you first posted, like you shot something that you put online for strangers to look at.
I think like the first time I ever, so I when I first moved out here, we were doing this show called Roommates.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just about...
And who is the we?
Me and Cooper Tomlinson.
Who is one of the co-stars of the movie, yeah.
Yeah, and he's like my writing partner in crime, and we do our sketch comedy show together and everything. He's great, but like I'm talking like week one. We met in school and we were already doing this thing called Roommates because we were just like, let's make something. Like yeah. we just had the bug. And that was interesting. Like that was like getting 200 views, like 500 uh-huh. views, small things.
Yeah.
But then the first thing that really, really hit it off for me, like, oh my God, I'm a director, was The Chair. It was a short mm-hmm. film I made for like $2,000, which is funny enough, even more expensive than my Milk and Cereal
yeah.
movie. But I made it for like $2,000. Most of that went to the DP. I remember writing it. And it was, I had this like small friend group where like we would write short films, or even some of our friends were writing features. I wasn't at that level yet, yeah. but some of my friends were, and we would all gather and do like these little table reads.
Great. Mm-hmm.
So when I had this like Chair script, I was like, I'm gonna order some food and I'm gonna get everybody mm-hmm. together and we're gonna do a table read of this. And it just didn't feel, people didn't like it that
yeah.
much.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
And I was like, no, you don't understand. It's gonna be weird. Like, you know, and I honestly felt like a naive amount of confidence because
yeah.
I was like, no, I've got an idea for this. But people were like, I don't get it. Just, it doesn't make sense. And like,
well, there is, and this is the burden that we share as writers of things that are supposed to be filmed. It's different.
Yeah.
And it is in and of itself, there is a bit of a craft in trying to take something on the page and add a little bit of extra that maybe sometimes is not even necessary.
Mm-hmm.
To help get them where you want it to be. But sometimes there are things that just need to be made. They can't, you won't get it any other way.
Well, and that's right. A real benefit I think your generation had is that you got the chance to experiment a lot. Because like, I've seen a lot of the sketches you did with Cooper and many of them are great. But I also suspect there were ones that probably weren't great that you just didn't put up or
yeah,
you took
yeah.
down. And which is also a luxury because when you're making a making something in an afternoon, if it's great, fantastic, it's great. If it sucks, you don't have to show it to the world.
I can't take any of my shit.
Whereas opposed to a movie, the stakes are so much higher, you have to release that movie
right.
at some point.
Totally. And that's so, so true. Like the experimental phase for me is over. Like it's kind of
yeah.
a scary thing. It's like there's a, even if I were to do a short film,
yeah,
that
the spotlight
would be on it. It would be like, what? You know.
And yet,
the stakes are actually lower than you think. Yeah.
it will all be an experiment from here on out anyway.
Right.
It's just that everyone's staring at you now in the lab.
Right.
Craig and I both, I think, wish you like the most successful failure at
Fail
some point.
Out loud just as much as you've succeeded out loud. You have no option now anyway.
Right.
But take big swings.
I just want to sort of point out that we've had smart guests who've come on the show who would strongly underline what you're saying. Like Courtney Kemp was on recently and she was talking about how if she were starting today, she would get together with a group of friends and just shoot a bunch of stuff and learn how to do it because that's how you do things now. Mike Birbiglia has been on the show and talking about like getting a pizza and getting all his friends around to read early drafts of things. That's smart. Mm-hmm. And what I think is crucial about this is it's finding a group of people you like and you trust who are trying to do the same things.
Right.
And it sounds like that's moving from Alabama to Los Angeles was how you got that process started.
Yeah, I got lucky too. I mean, I don't think it's always going to happen that way to find a group of people. I mean, going to film school, hopefully will find people that have similar interests. And I think to me, that's the most important part of film school is like meeting people out.
Yeah.
First of all, it gets you out here, mm-hmm. right? Like
I'm
in a small town. It was an excuse to leave. It felt like...
In which film school?
It was the New York Film Academy. It was in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It got me out here. Like it didn't feel like I was just on my own. It felt like at least I had something. I was going to school. I had an immediate schedule.
You had a structure.
Right. But the thing I got from it the most was just the people and that I met along the way. And I only was there for like a year.
Mm-hmm.
When you decided to come out, you know, whether it's film school or not, I think you made a choice that a lot of people struggle with. And we do advise this all the time. And I feel bad sometimes.
Yeah.
Because people will ask, well, I live, fill in the blank, Billings, Montana.
Yeah.
And I really want to make it. Do I have to move to LA? Yeah. No, I mean, no.
Right.
It gets easier. Then I think we feel a little worried that we're luring a lot of people who have no chance.
Right.
But then I think, but wait, we also have to lure the people who do have a chance.
Yeah.
Right. And I think you don't have to worry because the people that don't have a chance, I hate to say it like that, yeah. Jesus. But
there are people that don't have a chance.
Right. Well, those people will weed themselves out anyway.
Yes.
Because the people that have a chance are the people that won't give up. And in that case, at least they got to see a cool city and be here for a little bit. And also, I mean, you're right in that you probably do have to move here because it just keeps you dreaming. You have to keep dreaming. And like, if I was at home, I would probably feel like this stuff was so far away
right.
that I would just be like, after 2 years, I would have given up.
Yeah.
But being here and seeing Warner Brothers and wanting to be on the other side of that fence so bad.
Yeah, because the New York Film Academy, it's right by Warner Brothers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
it's
right.
Like across from Universal.
It's
right there.
I'm like, there it is.
There it is.
That's where I want to...
And your group of friends, they're doing stuff.
Yeah.
It's not like you can sit around and go, well, it's impossible. And then a week later, three of your friends are like, hey, come on over and watch the thing I just did. Well, now you feel like a lazy piece of shit.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
It keeps you like...
The culture is one of making things.
It really is.
Give us a sense of that first year or two sort of in Los Angeles. So you're going to this program, you're making a bunch of stuff. Are you also working? Like what was the hustle? What was the grind?
First, I was in school, didn't do anything. Then I had like a job at a burger joint. And then I had a very small time editing job, which to me felt like such a cool thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh. But it was like editing these little commercials for like local things, like a local little kids soccer team. And like, but I was like getting hired to like edit these things. And then I worked at Starbucks for like a year and a half.
Yeah.
Got yourself some health insurance.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, at one point I was working on a show called This Is Us mm-hmm. for like 2 years. First I was a COVID monitor.
All right.
During COVID.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. And I was
that's
like,
a whole job.
I was the person that everyone hated, like handing
you
the masks.
You were the COVID monitor.
Yeah.
Everyone hated.
Yeah.
The COVID monitor, that's the worst job.
It was the worst, but
no one likes you.
I was.
You're on sets.
Everyone was so nice on This Is Us. And I guess I was a very ballsy guy because I would just go up to Milo or Yatsu, who's a DP. And just talk and ask them questions. And they were nice.
Yeah.
Like they were nice enough to like even like give me their... I was like sending them short films and like it's so crazy that they were nice enough to talk to the COVID monitor.
You know, the thing is, if you're not crazy and you're not boring, it's wonderful to talk to anybody on a set, you know? Like just, it's cool. Every now and then you do get somebody who's a little boring and or crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, people actually do want to encourage the next generation to come on up and come along. I think, in general.
Yeah.
What I'm hearing through all of these anecdotes is that you just have a lot of agency. You take a lot of agency. You're sort of like, this is the thing I want. You're not as sort of asking permission. You're sort of just sort of, in a very kind and appropriate way, you're saying like, you're not waiting until for someone to invite you in. You're just saying like, hey, can I talk to you about this thing?
Yeah, I guess so. It's just so funny because I never would have considered myself that type of person. I'm very like chill. But I just, I did have that attitude of just, I'm doing what you're doing. I want to.
Well, maybe this is why the writing in your story rings so true, because everybody who is one thing is also the other thing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And here we have Bear.
Yeah.
Is the most timid.
Yeah.
Diffident, don't take chances, terrified, so terrified of success or even trying.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can occupy that as honestly as you did unless it's there.
Yeah.
And we are like reactions to ourselves sometimes. You know, it's like,
right.
Don't be that guy. Go be this guy and do that.
Ooh, that's an interesting observation.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
That you can't, I don't think you could write that character that well if you're just effortlessly alpha.
Yeah, you know right, I mean? Totally. Yeah, totally. Yeah,
that there's this aspect of it. And I'm kind of curious, in your writing process, you do something so beautifully in the movie, and it's very writerly. You are able to occupy two people in a scene with two people, and those two people are so wildly different.
Yeah.
They don't know what's going on in the other person's mind. They don't even understand really the truth of what the other person's saying. We watch them.
Yeah.
And we want to be like, oh my God, can I do therapy for the two of you?
Right, right.
Not hearing each other or seeing each other.
I love it.
How do you get to that because it's just you.
I love writing dialogue where two people misunderstand each other, which is exactly what you just described. And so when you start from a place of wanting that, which is, by the way, just already a captivating way to write any scene, honestly, is like one person wants one thing and the other person wants a different thing. But then, you know, I wanted every single character in this movie to have different perspectives. And it's so interesting to have, like, you know, Sarah is saying, you know, Nikki is taking advantage of you. She's using her opportunity of her dad dying to latch on to you, and that's not healthy. And then, which is so crazy from what's actually happening.
Right.
But like, what a fun thing to write that like one person has this crazy perspective and but you know, as the audience that, and also I really, really like to write from like one perspective.
Uh-huh.
Like, which is like Bear.
Right.
And so you can hear what Sarah and Ian are saying, but you don't follow them home and see their story. You stay with Bear. You know?
So your limited point of view, but we actually understand the other characters, but we're sort of locked to point of view on him, which makes sense. It reminds me of Jon Favreau in Swingers. So this character who we appreciate, we adore, he's making bad choices and we're with him while he's making bad choices. You've set up a character in Bear who feels like he is in romantic comedy, and yet the genre of the movie isn't letting him be in romantic comedy.
The voice message scene in Swingers is kind of like the comedy version of Obsession.
Yeah, it's cringe because we're so embarrassed on his behalf, and yet it just keeps going worse and worse, and that is kind of what's happened with Bear up until he sort of cracks the willow.
Yeah.
Again, a credit to the way you approach things, because I think you never villainized anyone, really. Even what he does in and of itself, it's not an act of crime. He's just going, I wish. If it's a crime, it's a crime of cowardice.
Right.
But it's not, there was no expectation.
Absolutely not. Which is so funny because I see people make these videos of like, if Bear would have worded his wish differently, like,
oh,
I wish that
good Lord.
I'm like,
that's not what this is
that's
about.
That's not, he didn't.
If only he were a lawyer, this would have worked out great.
Yeah.
No.
Or like, I wish I had the confidence to, which I get that, like saying the correct thing, but like it was a toy.
It was a toy.
He didn't know it was going to work. That's the whole point.
The whole point. It was just this goofy set. It was almost like when he does it, it's like, this is how much I suck.
Right.
I'm doing this. But it was, what I appreciated was how I understood how he felt. I felt that way. I think actually, everyone in the world at some point or another has experienced obsession, or what's the limerence? Is that the word that people use a lot? And of wanting another person and feeling helpless. It's not even that you think they would want you back. You're just scared to ask. You know they don't.
Yeah.
Right.
And you're lost, but you can't seem to get out of it. Everyone's had this feeling. So it's incredibly relatable. But also, I think maybe not everybody, but almost everybody's had the feeling of understanding. I think that person wants me. It's not going to happen. How do I sort of deal with that?
Yeah.
So I was both of them.
Right.
The whole time.
One thing that's so important to note here is that Bear is making a choice and Bear is kicking off the action of the movie. He's protagonizing the way you want him to sort of start the story. And yet you as the filmmaker are still doing the thing we always urge our writers to do is you are torturing your hero. You are making things awful for your hero. And you're building this sort of moral staircase where like he keeps making choices that are kind of reasonable in the moment but are actually worse overall for him and for everyone else around him. And to your credit, it works. And we can kind of feel your hands doing that. We're delighted because that is also the genre. It's the nature of the kind of story we sat down to see, which is fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to like talk about it and at such a high, like emotionally intelligent level at this point, because when I first was writing it, it was just raw. Like,
yeah, okay.
You know what I mean? It's like...
Well, tell us about those early drafts. Tell us about like, you know, what you thought the movie was as you were sitting down to start writing it.
I knew that I wanted to do some crazy things with Nikki and that, well, in the Chair short film that I did, there was this girl character who kind of would like flip from different emotions. Yep. And I was like, I want to do a movie where that's the whole gimmick.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so then this came to me, I was like, oh my God, I can do that Chair thing that I really liked with the girl. And like, this can be that movie. And like something that's really cool about this movie is that it lends itself well to being in the horror genre, like in a way that other ideas I have don't, where I'm like, where's like the scary angle? This idea, just the obsession of some, it's scary. Like it's scary to have someone feel so strongly about you in real life. Yeah. It really is. And
it was really, I thought, so smart, even though Bear's the protagonist, he's the character we're following, and so much of it is through his perspective. We do feel through Nikki like we can see, and you give her moments where she gets to come back, where we understand she's like those people that have locked-in syndrome, which is the most terrifying thing. And now I'm with her.
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
I'm just imagining the terror of what this must feel like. And on both sides of it, the desire to love someone that doesn't love you, we all know the power of that feeling. The feeling of not being in control of yourself, we also know that feeling. If I were to write a think piece about why this movie works, it just comes down to it is a hyper presentation of stuff we have all felt. Mm-hmm. And we must feel it because it goes to what love and desire is, which are beneath our forebrains.
Right.
And that is where the scary stuff is.
Right. Wow, that's interesting.
As you were working on this in the writing, in the directing, and in the editing, where did you find the line between like, we are in a horror space and this is a comedy? Because so much of what you're setting up is essentially a comedy premise where like this girl is so obsessed with you. Like that's a comedy.
There is a Jim Carrey version of this movie.
Totally.
Yeah. And so where did you find moments where you had to sort of pivot between those two?
Well, the funny thing is that it just kind of comes naturally for me because I'm not like when I was, I think like 17, I was still in high school and I saw J.J. Abrams say on a podcast or something, the most successful people in life don't take themselves too seriously. And I don't know what it is about that statement that just stuck with me. And it was like, whoa, it just freed me up because I was like, so I don't have to like take this seriously. And I know that sounds like, you know, you don't take it seriously, whatever, but like, don't take the art too seriously because there's something freeing about you watch these horror movies that are so brute and like, this is serious and we need to figure this out. And it's like, but what if that was real? Then you would probably be, you know, you would talk different. You would
say, what if that were real?
Yeah.
I cannot tell you how often I will say some version of the following thing. Okay, but what would really happen?
Yes.
When I read somebody's script and I'm like, okay, this moment is a very interesting moment, but everything that happens after that, and we do this with our... How would an actual human being respond in this circumstance?
Exactly, man. Yeah.
And I do think it's a good thing that JJ said there. And I love that you come from a comedy background. And there is something about comedy and horror that just they're like twin siblings.
Well, they both revel in being uncomfortable and just sitting in a really uncomfortable place and like not letting it resolve.
And getting to squishy stuff underneath.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without taking itself... It shouldn't take itself so seriously.
Here's an example. People would think, oh, this is a comedy scene, But like the morning after, when Bear wakes up, he's checking his hair in the mirror, and he goes up to her and he's like, let's not do that anymore.
Yeah.
Like, that's funny. And people think it's funny, but it's also honest.
Yes. Yeah.
Because in every horror movie, crazy things happen. And then the next day, the characters just ignore it. Like, and like, dude, you just saw some crazy shit. Let's talk about it out loud, because that's what you would do.
What would you do in this circumstance?
Exactly.
And there are kinds of stories where everything just feels a bit elevated because of the nature of it. Yeah. If it's a fantasy or something like this, we understand that, like, in Lord of the Rings, like, I always think it's funny, like, when people die in a movie like Lord of the Rings, everyone should just stop and vomit. Do you know what I mean? But like, but they don't, because that's the world they live in, and I get it. It's fine.
Yeah.
And maybe you can accept in a world where war is every day and then people die left and right. It's like, fine.
Yes, fine. But in a story like this, where I'm basically a kid and I work at a music shop.
Yeah.
And I really like this girl. Even blood, anything.
Literally.
Yeah.
Is enough to shatter you. You will talk, if nothing else happened except that one night, he would be in therapy about it for a while anyway.
Yeah.
So I love that you like go right to that question. Like, what would really happen?
And it's the same, it's almost like when you ask that one question, it opens up so many genres. You can think about, ooh, but what's the version of this movie that we've seen 100 times? What's the version of it where it happened in real life?
In real life.
And then you're like, it just kind of excites you. Like, you know what I mean? That's why a simple idea doesn't scare me off. It excites me, because I can think about, oh, but what if it's raw and real and the reactions are...
You almost want, the more real you're going to be, the simpler you want the idea to be.
Yeah,
totally.
The more complicated and large the concept, I think then almost the characters start to have to drift away from grounded.
Because there's no way to push the plot forward without them doing... So. You would go to the hospital. Okay, well, that's boring. Now the rest of the movie takes place at the hospital. Yeah. Like, there's so many things you have that do kind of drag. Like, you know, even this ghost movie that me and Cooper just wrote, so many times we were like, we want to do the absolute most bonkers crazy thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, ooh, what if we killed off this character right here? It'd be crazy. It's like, yeah, but there's con artists. They would just give up and go home and be sad. Like, they wouldn't like carry out the rest of the...
Right.
You know, so we're constantly thinking about that. And also like not wanting to answer anything is such a challenging way to write, because, you know, when you're saying to me, we understand that she's popping into her body at this point in the movie. I never had a scene where Bear's going to Ian and saying, I think she's like popping back into her body.
Yeah,
and I think, right? You just understand it. But like, when you write that way, you have to talk to people and be like, did you understand like this? And like,
did you, for this particular movie, was there a process where you, after you make the movie and you cut it together, did you, for lack of a better phrase, test screen?
Yeah. We did a test screening with... I had just gotten with UTA and they let us use their screening room. And we, Haley, the producer, put on Instagram, free movie. Because we didn't want to get friends and family.
Right,
we wanted to get random people.
I'm with you on that one.
But it was just us doing it. It wasn't like some like super...
NRG or any of those research companies.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was just us. And so we got as random as we could of people. And we all gave them papers and made them write down things. And the number one thing that people said is they were frustrated with Bear and that they didn't understand why he wasn't making more effort to like fix it. And by the way, you've seen the movie as it is. You haven't seen the movie before the reshoot.
This is how it touches.
Well, there you go. So you learned something.
I did learn something.
Right.
And what's really interesting is that I kind of did the thing that you hear about in stories where didn't take the note. I took the note behind the note, which is everybody wanted me to fix Bear and make him go to that crystal shop sooner to like find the One Wish Willow and try to fix it sooner. And I was like, okay, I get it now. The problem is that I haven't done a good enough job of telling people that Bear wants this to work.
Exactly.
Mm. Yeah. He's
not ready to undo it yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that scene that I was just talking about with the haircut and he comes and he explains that to her, that was a reshoot.
All right.
Before we had this other scene where he's like, where were you? And she's like, I was in the room. And like the twist is that she was like on the ceiling and it was cool, but it just didn't. But then I was able to come up with an idea of a scene where he's trying to say, please don't do that anymore because it freaks me out. And then she says, I promise you I won't. And he goes, good.
She gives him permission to keep going.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So here we have one of our favorite and most horrifying things in writing, which is logic.
Yeah.
And it is remarkable how people need it.
Right.
They need logic because—
Even if they don't know.
That's right. And we will trade on this concept of what would people really do? And we will get very far with it until we forget that maybe also people would really do this or this.
Yeah, right.
And we forgot to do that. And boy, they go right to it, don't they? It's amazing.
Right.
So two examples I can think of on terms of like, what would people really do? I just rewatched Get Out, which we should do a deep dive on Get Out. It's so spectacular. Awesome. But you are right there with your hero in terms of like, something is really messed up here and I'm going to leave. I'm going to leave. We're going to go right now. And he tries to leave at the right appropriate moments. And there's the social pressures convincing him to stay, but he doesn't. Also Blair Witch Project in terms of just like, these are characters who are encountering these weird things and they're responding the ways, they're freaking out in the ways that they should freak out. And so a lesson we kind of tend to forget in genre is that people don't know they're in a genre. They're just experiencing life.
Right.
And therefore, it does become corny when they don't appear to be behaving the way we do. And then you get the classic movie theater moment of, why are you going in there?
Why are you going into the house?
I think it's great that you had that experience. It speaks to why I think anybody who is going to do this for a long time, right off the bat, you've said like two things that are very important. One is, okay, I don't take myself so seriously. I take the work seriously. I don't take myself seriously.
Right.
Which means I leave room to be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm not wrong because they say they don't like something. I'm wrong if I say, oh, wait, I know why they don't like something. I did something wrong. I see what it is. Let me fix it.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And it comes from that J.J. Abrams quote from a long time. And I'm just like, dang, it is that. I see people that do take themselves too seriously and it paralyzes themselves.
Yeah.
Like I went to a film school where, you know, friends would have these short films and they would spend years on this like one short film because they just wanted to get it right.
Yeah.
And it's like, bro, release it.
There is no right.
Yeah.
Work
on the next one.
Work on the next one.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of paralysis, I think, that happens. There's somebody did a study, like a statistical study once, of Oscar award winning directors. And the time in between movies after someone wins an Oscar is like twice as long as the normal time between movies. Because they become paralyzed and start to think, okay, well, now I'm an Oscar award-winning director. My next film must be Oscar worthy of my greatness.
Right.
And they just stop.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like, I know I didn't win an Oscar, but I'm feeling that pressure now. And like, it's not, I won, all these awards are breaking. Like, Better Than E.T. came out and like beat Blair Witch. And I'm just like, I'm almost like, stop. I'm like, slow down. I didn't ask for this, you know?
Yes.
It's like, it's just a crazy amount of success that that movie is having. And
one of the advantages you have here is that you were already shot this next movie. So it's not like, if you were prepping another movie right now, or that
you didn't know what you were going to do.
Or like, you know, here's this $100 million thing that you're going to do. We would turn off the cameras and we would caution you not to stop you from doing this.
Right.
But I do think the fact that you have another movie that's, you already know is going to happen is you're actually already editing. Is a good step.
Yeah.
But it's in your mind now, right? So you partly you just have to kind of now go through the miserable exercise of forcing yourself to stop thinking about it.
Right.
And to not put what you do now in the perspective of what just happened.
Yeah.
Because it can be terrifying. And by the way, it's okay if the best thing you ever did is, something has to be the best thing you ever did.
Yeah. Right.
It may be that this is not. I'm fully rooting for you.
Yeah.
That there's something bigger and better. But you kind of just have to forget about it.
Yeah.
So one thing, you do tend to look to other people and say like, oh, what did they do? What did they? And this may be a good moment to look at like other folks who are in similar kind of circumstances and sort of learn from them in terms of like what filmmakers you loved who like followed up a big hit with another thing that was really great and interesting. That's the track to follow and not look at sort of the negative examples of the people who just like then spun around for years and years because we know them and it's tough.
It's hard.
Yeah.
You're in it now. It's impossible to see when you're inside of it and you look back. 20 years later, you may say, this is crazy. Because there are filmmakers like this who their first six movies out of the gate are massive and awesome. And then there's like 10 more movies that nobody wants or likes. There are filmmakers who go on, off, on, off, on, off. There are ones who come in clumps. There are ones who just ride along on a B minus the whole time. But you don't know.
Yeah. Right.
All you can do is what you do in the moment as best you can do it and not repeat yourself. Just trying to not repeat yourself.
And that's scary. That's hard.
It is. It's scary.
Harder to say. Because I want to repeat happened.
Of course.
And you're kind of comparing. You're like, oh my gosh, like what worked with this? Why was it resonating with people? Is my next idea, is it deep enough to, am I known as the deep guy now? Like all these things that I'm just trying, trust me, and I am. I'm trying to push them out.
You can't completely. I mean, listen, I went on many long walks talking to myself, trying to figure out which disaster would be the best disaster for me to make a television show about after I made a show about a disaster. Like, okay, well, that's what I do now.
I'm a disaster guy now.
There was no Chernobyl too.
I would be insane to not keep doing the disasters now, right?
Like,
and then I would just have to repeatedly hit myself in the face and say, do not.
Yeah. Wow, yeah.
But you have to almost forgive yourself for all of the instincts to be afraid. And by the way, if you do repeat yourself, you repeat yourself.
Yeah.
So that's okay too. Cause I mean, God knows how many sequels I did in my life. I mean, I was being paid, you know?
But right, like, right, right.
It's all in service of something. All of it.
I love this is the most niche advice we can give to a person. Like after your giant hit, here's how to follow off the giant hit. But
We might as well talk about it.
But something that would be very practical for a lot of our listeners is how do you make that first movie? Because you've made a ton of shorts, you made sketches, you know how to shoot stuff, but now you have a script and you actually have to go try to film a thing. What was your process? You mentioned a producer, ultimately you mentioned UTA, but how did that all come together?
Yeah, I mean, so I'd already made Milk and Cereal, but nobody had seen
it. Milk and Cereal is found footage.
It's a found footage, like 60-minute movie. It's almost considered a short film, but it's just long enough to be considered a feature.
It's a long short.
Yeah, it's a very long short, which the first cut was an hour 20, which is, there's no doubt that it's a feature. So I had done that and I'd done The Chair and I did like one more horror film, but like this producer, James Harris, reached out and said, hey, listen, I have this like program where I find a filmmaker and I give them X amount of money and give them basically a shot. And if you have an idea, I liked Your Chair. Are you doing a feature of The Chair? Yeah. Is that something? And at the time, I had actually written a feature for The Chair. Mm. And I was like, oh my gosh. Like, yeah, I have The Chair. And my manager was like, well, The Chair could be like a cool IP, which by the way, we're doing nothing with now. But but at the time, it was like, you'd already written The Chair. Like, why don't you see if there's something else for it? Maybe we could have a bigger budget for The Chair and we could save that. And maybe there's a different idea. And I was like, well, I have this obsession idea. I'd written the short film of it. I had had the idea. This was after the Simpsons episode. Yeah. It was after, like I was excited about this.
Yeah.
And so I told him, I was like, okay, I'll do Obsession. I pitched Obsession to James. And his response was basically, I like this idea, but why don't you write the script?
Well, sure.
And right. So what you pitched him was a lot of like what we saw in the movie, the four characters that set up.
I pitched him that it was a movie about a guy that makes a wish that this girl becomes obsessed with him and she becomes, and I pitched it as a possession movie.
Yeah.
But it was a love story, possession movie gone wrong thing. And
obsession. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it felt, he dug it.
Yeah.
But he was also like, yeah, it's been done before, but I dig it. And why don't you write it? And so I started, oh my God, this is a huge opportunity for me. Which, you know what? Like looking back, that gives me some sort of hope or makes me feel better that like I was still under pressure then.
Yeah.
It's just a different type of pressure. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, maybe it was even more pressure because it was like, this has to be good. And
yeah.
Oh yeah.
I never thought about that. Like I never thought like this has to be good. I always just was like, do, like just stream of consciousness.
Well, when nothing's happened yet, you are about as free as you'll ever be.
Yeah, right, right.
And in a way, trying to shut everything out to be that free again is part of the challenge.
Yeah. When I wrote Go, there was no expectation that it had to be a thing.
No,
I was writing the movie I wanted to write.
Yes. And so sometimes you just have to turn on, you have to turn all of it off. Everybody out there will drown you. Even their love will drown you. Their hatred will drown you. The love will drown you. The think pieces, the criticism, the awards, all that, which is designed to celebrate what you've done, in a way is kind of corrosive, because what you've done, you did.
Mm-hmm.
And we're always like,
yeah,
dreaming.
It's so crazy, humans.
Yes.
I think about this. I'm like, I'm having the biggest hit ever right now. And I'm thinking about what's my next movie. Like, I can't even for one second
enjoy
this. Well, I'm already thinking about what's my next one, and even next one.
Okay, so good news, bad news. Bad news is you will never enjoy it.
Yeah. Wow, that sucks.
Good news. This is the best, most striking sign that you will continue to succeed. That is the thing that keeps people going.
Right.
Because the people who were motivated by success, when they get it, they don't realize it, but they just got fed. They're not hungry anymore.
Mm.
But if that's not what you're hungry for, if what you're hungry for is the next dream and thing.
It's crazy how it means nothing to me.
Yeah.
It drives me nuts, actually.
I'm so really sorry, and I get it.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
this should mean so much to me.
Yeah.
This is so crazy. And I'm seeing, but I'm like, but now I'm like, it almost just makes me angry. Like, yeah, it doesn't make me excited. It makes me, I'm like jealous of myself.
Yeah.
How is that even possible,
yes,
you know?
Jealous of yourself. Disappointed in yourself for not being enlightened enough to enjoy it. Jealous of the guy who did that thing because you don't know how he did that, really.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're like, did I even do it?
Right.
And it's terrifying. And then you do it again.
Yeah.
This is your personal heaven hell. But that's, I think the people who do what we do, mm-hmm, and who do it at length and who have, it's not, everything's not always a success, but repeated success. This is part of it.
Right.
Is this feeling. I'm suspicious of people who are, you know what, for the next 4 months, I'm just going to enjoy this moment.
Yeah, yeah. Right. What?
What?
How are you not thinking, oh my God, I got to do that again?
Right.
And how am I going
to not terrified? That's a huge day for me.
Right.
You know, so I love hearing this. This means we're going to get a lot more movies out of you.
Yeah.
This is great.
Well, I'm not, and that's kind of a thing. I'm trying to figure out what my pace is.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of my heroes, like Ari Aster, even Zach Cregger, even Jordan Peele, they don't come out with movies every year.
I think Zach Cregger is working pretty hard.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
But
Jordan Peele is taking a slower pace.
Your heroes are not you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your pace is your pace.
Is your pace.
Yeah. And if I'm not doing something, I would go crazy.
Yeah. Then your pace is your pace.
Yeah.
And there are people who put out a movie a year, some of them famously. And no one who puts out a movie a year makes all good movies.
Right.
No.
They make a lot of movies. And Luca Guadagnino is out there making a movie every 16
Soderbergh,
days.
Yeah.
Soderbergh, who retired 20 years ago.
Yeah. Night.
Quote unquote.
Makes a movie every month. Right. They just keep coming. Right. That's the pace. Your pace is your pace.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about that.
Quick questions before we sort of move into One Cool Things. You wrote the script. You gave it to the producer. The producer said, thumbs up. You shot a ton of shorts. You shot a bunch of sketches. What from your YouTube experience applied and what didn't apply? Like what things did you have to sort of figure out is different?
That's a good question.
Because you're working with a professional set. You're working with probably a bigger, much bigger team than you're used to.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think like I've said this a lot on other platforms, but like the YouTube comments have taught me a lot about that people are really smart.
Yeah.
Which is like not always the thing you learn on online.
You don't hear that about YouTube comments. Yeah.
But like it's just people are picking up on things. You know that thing we talked about that was like, when you don't give any answers, you almost have to ask people, are you getting this? Do you understand? And the answer is yes. Like as long as you're telling it through subtext enough, people are getting it. And learning that through YouTube comments has given me the confidence to like treat my audience like they're smart.
Yeah.
Yes.
In a way that maybe I wouldn't have learned. So I like to give credit to that. But also now I've actually learned that comments are very bad for me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like someone said recently, and I was like, oh my God, I love that. That like comments are like food, that you put it in your body and you're choosing to digest that.
Mm.
And if you just don't eat it, then you don't have to, you can eat an entire thing of chocolate cake or you can just not eat that chocolate cake and like, whether you, right? It's like,
yes.
What's the difference between YouTube comments and reviews? Like, are you reading reviews or you're not? Like,
reviews are the new modern YouTube comments.
Those are just long form YouTube comments.
It's so funny because people were like, what's it like going into a medium where there were comments and now there's not? I was like, there are.
There are comments.
Yes.
So
I've struggled with this my whole life or at least my whole professional life. And where I kind of landed was, I think that it's me as my most kind of childlike, mm-hmm. trying to get what I should have gotten and didn't, which is some sort of perfect, beautiful, unconditional love and acceptance. Mm. And you look for that and you will get it from some of that stuff. Mm-hmm. It will mean nothing. Mm-hmm. And then the punches come and you will feel those so much more.
I know.
Like 200 I love yous in one punch and all you think about all day is the punch. Because it was not a healthy exercise in the first place. Because you're looking for something that ultimately you don't actually need or even want.
Right.
You just have to sit with your own awareness that you didn't make something perfect. You are trying to get better. There is a corrosive aspect to it and there is almost an indulgence. It's like almost like a suicidal indulgence.
It is. Like, it is. You feel like you're doing...
Yes.
You literally are like, I hope the next one's not negative, but you're still struggling. Yeah. Like,
you're waiting for it.
Yeah,
it's so great. It's like people who don't stop gambling until they've lost everything.
It is the emotional slot machine. Yeah.
It's emotional slot machine. It's bad for you.
So let me try to distinguish between, there's the comments you get on the thing that's still in process and like, you know, someone who you want to read an early draft of your script to see like, are they getting it? Or like, you know, people who are seeing this at UTA, the test screening to see like, oh, is this working? But at a certain point when the thing is finished, you just have to be finished with it and stop reading.
Right, because there's nothing to be...
You can't do anything.
There's no such thing about constructive criticism because there's no construction
there's
to
no
be done.
There's no construction anymore.
Yeah.
Construction complete.
Yes.
You just don't like it. And it is me. Mm. You don't like me.
Yeah.
You rejected me, which... I mean, and you can see how intense that feeling is in your movie.
Yeah.
The feeling of being rejected and unwanted is baked into the movie.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I would strongly urge you. It's hard.
Yeah.
It requires an enormous amount of ego strength. I'm going to deny myself the cheap thrill of fake love.
Yeah. Right.
To protect myself from.
It's so true.
Yeah. It's hard though. It's hard.
But the difference is the like videos and stuff. Cause I know you asked what's the difference between like YouTube stuff versus like the more traditional stuff. And like nobody makes video essays about, I mean, people did about Milk and Cereal and stuff, but I mean, arguably that was a feature film. Yeah. And so, but like, it's really cool to like see the videos of people talking about it. And like, that just feels so much different, more different than, cause you can read the comments of that and that's a bad thing.
Yeah. Hey, don't read that.
But the videos...
Or someone's actually taking the time to look at, pull apart, to contextualize things. Sure, I can see that being helpful.
I mean, I'm just also really lucky that it's been mostly positive for Obsession as far as like people like having opinions about it.
You may still need to stop watching those too.
I know, I will and I should.
It's you can have somebody in your life who curates a little bit for you.
Yeah.
And you can say, listen, if you see something that you know, it's not just somebody going, best thing ever or it sucked. But somebody who, say, goes, okay, I'm going to make a 10-minute video about the use of perspective in Obsession.
Yeah.
That is some sort of thoughtful, analytical thing that isn't about praise or condemnation, just an exploration of something that we do out of respect. Maybe somebody in your life can say, hey, this one's safe for you.
Check it out.
Check this one out.
Right.
We have curation on the Script Notes book reviews. And so like—
Oh, we do?
Yeah. So like on the Goodreads reviews—
I have not looked at them.
So I think I sent the one thing I sent one thing through to you, which was like this essay that was like, I couldn't believe how long it was, but it was actually like really smartly done. And like the fact that this person had spent all this time really looking at sort of what we did on the Script Notes book was actually meaningful. It's like, oh, that connected.
Well, they spent time on it.
They spent time on
it. So that it mattered to them. It wasn't just some barf.
Yeah.
You know, so much of it out there is just somebody going, blah, 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 next.
And they don't even think about how it could affect somebody at all.
They don't think about what they just wrote within a millisecond after they hit send. It's gone.
And they may even change their, that's the funny thing. They may even change their mind the next day.
Yeah, but they're not going to go back and change their
idea. Yeah, but you're just stuck with the comment.
Yeah. That's
forever.
Right.
Forever.
Forever.
All right, let's do our one cool things. My one cool thing, so this was a study that was done and I want to pose it to you and so you can tell us what you think the results were. So if you have a bunch of people, school children even, just in an empty space and just tell them to wander around for 10 minutes, which direction are they going to turn? Are they going to turn individually, turn clockwise or counterclockwise?
They have to turn. Straight ahead is not an answer.
They can move straight ahead, but an empty field. And so eventually they're going to start turning around. They're not going to just wander off forever.
I mean, my gut is that most people are right-handed. They're going to go towards their dominant hand, and I'm going to say to the right.
I was like this way.
Yeah, right. Clockwise.
Clockwise. Yeah. It's counterclockwise.
What is wrong with
universally us? Around the world, and it can't figure out why. And so they've done
even in upside down places like Australia.
Yeah. So I'll put a link to the New York Times article about this. It's written by Rachel Neuer, and if you look at the comments on that. Everyone says like, oh, but they should do it in the Southern Hemisphere because of Coriolis effect. That's not true. That's not real.
Can I tell you something weird?
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've had this experience. In fact, I know you haven't. No one else has except for me. I'm the only one. And this is far beyond random probability at this point. When I write something, I try and be very visual about the space and I imagine the moments happening. I'm going to say 90% of the time, when the production designer comes and shows me, or somebody does a previs or an illustration or storyboard, they've put everybody in the other direction.
It drives me crazy.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I go, okay, well, I imagine them the other way. But everyone's like, oh, that's weird. We all imagined it like this. And I can't explain it.
Yeah.
I'm backwards in my head from everybody. And I don't know why. It's actually terrifying.
I mean, I kind of know what you're saying because... anytime, like if I didn't explain exactly where the couch was supposed to go or then it's always in the wrong spot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's going on?
But in my head, it's so clear that the couch is right here. Yeah.
So
is it like how our retinas have an upside down image that gets like flipped back into our brain? What is happening?
As far as this study goes, they've a bunch of different theories and none of them pan out. And so they really have no idea. So scientists it's an active area of exploration. It could just be like we are biologically inclined to turn to the left and they're not sure why. But if you blindfold people, it
doesn't
work the same. And so if you blindfold people and tell them to move straight, I think it's that bias isn't there.
Right.
But it's just a natural tendency.
Well, this is all a simulation, obviously.
Yeah. Handedness doesn't have anything to do with it.
So weird.
So,
but we both said right.
We both said right.
Because I was like, I'm going to go.
Because I imagined in my mind, and I think maybe this is the problem, is that whatever my brain does spatially, I can see it clearly. And then when I put it, however it comes out on the other end, people are getting the flipped image.
Yeah.
So weird.
Yeah.
So weird.
Yeah.
I would say probably 80% of scenes where I'm picturing a character entering into a space, I picture them entering in through the left. I picture them moving left to right across the screen. I'm sure statistically, if you actually look at the sort of the movies I've made and things, that's not the case, but I'm almost always picturing them entering into the frame from the left side of the frame.
Well, you read from left to right.
That's right. A part of it, yeah.
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 But then do people who read Arabic or Hebrew go the other way?
Yeah.
Right.
It's wild.
I just learned that like books, I don't know what if it's in Japan or China or just Asia in general, but books are flipped. I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a lot of different cultures where what we consider the back of the book is actually the front of the book and you're going the other way through.
I don't know.
Manga comics, I think, are back to front.
Yeah. You're reading left to right, but you're flipping progressively this way?
There's different ways it can work in different languages.
Yeah, manga comics is exactly what I'm talking about because I just got one.
Yeah.
And I was like, this looks like the back of the book. It was. I had to flip it. I'm like, wait, this feels so weird.
It does feel so weird.
Yeah.
Now that I think about it, when I went to Hebrew school where I learned zero Hebrew, except the Hebrew phrase for shut up, which every kid who goes to Hebrew school hears over, shaka b'vaka shat. That's all I remember is the teacher telling me to shut up. This is great education. But the books the cover was tipped like this, except you would read right to left as you were turning the pages this way,
right.
Which is very...
disconcerting.
Weird.
Yeah.
It's all backwards.
Yeah.
You make a movie about that. How often do you get that now?
Yeah.
You should make a movie about that. This is weird. Something happened that's vaguely and boringly weird to me.
Craig, do you want a cool thing?
I do. It's a little bit of a throwback to an old one, I'm pretty sure. It's a game, but it's newly released fairly newly released on iOS. So I think a long time ago, I did a one cool thing for a game called Curse of the Golden Idol.
Okay.
Which was available on Steam. And it's this very strange game. It's very surreal. The artwork is, sometimes there's art styles that are aggressively, purposefully ugly. Mm-hmm. This is that.
Hmm.
Grotesque somewhat.
Yeah.
It's a sort of a logic deduction game. You get a scene, you find these clues, and you have to piece together what's actually going on. And the scenes become progressively more and more difficult to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all logic. You become a little bit of a Sherlock Holmes as you go through it. And I liked it, but it was kind of interface-wise, it was a little difficult.
Yeah.
As it turns out, it was always supposed to be on iOS or some sort of touch-based because it's so simple now. It's so easy. And they've released two additional like DLC things for it. And underneath all of it is this very weird occult story that begins to unfold of a secret society doing some weird shit. So the story's kind of fun, but mostly it's just this really interesting exercise in being very logical and observant. And there's no time limit on it, which I had games that put a clock on me, I start to freak out.
Curse of the Golden Idol?
Case of the Golden Idol. So, I've been saying Curse of the Golden Idol the whole time. It's Case of the Golden Idol. I think the people who make it, they have like their company name, which we'll dig up here. It's like a Pantone or a hex code for a color.
Fantastic.
I think, which I thought you would enjoy. Yes. Color Gray Games. And their logo for Color Gray Games is like the hex
Pantone
code.
Chip. Pantone. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah. Anyway, the Case of the Golden Idol.
The Case of the Golden Idol. Curry, do you have one cool thing to share with us?
My dad, for Christmas last year, got me the Script Notes book.
Mm-hmm. You weren't a little insulted? Like, Dad, I know how to do this.
No, because I'm always like trying to learn and like, I still feel like I know nothing about writing. Like every day I'm like, oh, like, how do I learn more? What's the answer? I'm like constantly chasing. I want the Aaron Sorkin masterclass again. Like, what else can I learn? I'm like studying like Save the Cat. I'm studying like Hero's Journey and like trying to figure out what works better for me and also like trying to throw it away at the same time and like... Yeah. You know what I mean?
You'll find one day you will be teaching a masterclass where you have digested, synthesized all of it, mushed it with the things that are uniquely you, and you will then give something.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, three act structure is important, and that's kind of what I've figured out, I think.
So far, so good for you, I would have to say. Yeah. I wouldn't dig too. By the way, here's a one cool thing.
All right.
You're wearing a members only jacket. And that is the actual member. Is that like a vintage members only jacket? Right?
They still have them.
All right.
That's like a new version of the old members only jacket.
Yeah, but it's the same exact thing.
It's the exact one. Like I had
it's high
that.
School. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
I had that in 1985, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And when did members only in whatever the early 80s was like the coolest thing ever. And then like one day later, the least cool thing ever.
Oh, really?
And it wasn't like there wasn't a middle ground. It was like,
wow,
everyone had one. And then suddenly,
you're wearing one, you're lame.
Are you wearing a members only jacket?
Yeah.
You loser. And I'm like, oh, it was cool yesterday. What?
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah, I didn't even know that.
Like, it's all, I remember.
Yeah, so I assumed it was ironically cool, but it's just genuinely cool. That's the generational
split. I
think
now it's all the way just cool.
Everything my daughter wears is like found at vintage stores and thrifted.
My daughter as well. They could go thrifting together. 100%. She loves it.
It's reminding me, like, your daughter is in a similar situation where like with Curry, she's just making stuff herself and she's making music herself rather than making films herself. But like she just was able to do the thing that she wanted to do and didn't have to wait for the rest of the world to catch up.
She didn't have to wait for the rest of the world to catch up. They just sort of met her there, which is really, it's cool. And it's exciting. But I can, you know, she goes through these same things too. There is, not everybody survives the withering gaze of the world. It is slightly monkey's paw.
Yeah.
To be ironic.
Yeah.
You get what you wish for, and then you're like, oh no.
Yeah.
Well, Craig Barker, we wish you all the success and luck. We wish all these things for you. It's going to happen.
You might, by the way, because I don't want this to come out like a year later, and you're like, wait a second, you might see more members only jackets from me.
Oh,
right.
In a weird way that I won't say, but you're going to see it in like less than a year, and you're going to be like, what?
We were there right then.
We were there at the birth or the midlife.
It's not as random as you think.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
A little teaser there at the end.
A little Chekhov's members only jacket.
Script Notes is produced by Meredith Stedman.
I don't know.
Our intern is Lauren Loisberg. Our outro is by Matthew Cialelli. If you have an outro, we could use more outros. So please send links to those to ask@johnaugust.com. That's also the place where you can send questions like the ones we often answer on the show. We'll find transcripts at johnaugust.com along with a sign up for a weekly newsletter called Interesting, which has lots of links to things about writing. The Script Notes book is available wherever you buy books, just like Curry's dad did.
Yeah, cool guy.
Cool guy.
You can find clips and other helpful video on our YouTube. Just search for Script Notes and give us a follow. You'll find us on Instagram @Script Notes Podcast. We have t-shirts and hoodies and drinkware. You'll find those at Cotton Bureau.
I gotta get some drinkware, by the way.
Yeah, drinkware.
I need some.
Yeah.
How do I not have the drinkware?
I don't know.
I'm gonna get some.
Gotta get the drinkware.
Drinkware.
Yeah, drinkware.
You'll find show notes with the links to things we talked about today in the email you get each week as a premium subscriber. Thank you again to our premium subscribers.
Yeah.
They're the best.
They make this all possible.
You're gonna be getting a notice soon, premium subscribers. We also email you about special things, and you're gonna get a special little email soon.
Possibly a script notes theme members only jacket.
That's what it is.
There you go.
Because my understanding is that stuff's about to go.
Can you imagine an orange members only jacket?
We screw them over and we just like we salt the earth and members is like, oh my God, it's so overdone.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Dang. Yeah. I don't want the members only to be done before the thing.
No, we won't do that too. We promise.
I want them to come back when they're supposed to come
when
back.
When they're supposed to come back.
Which is coming soon.
Yeah. So
nice.
Curry Barker attempting to time culture, which I love.
So far, so good.
So far, so good. You can sign up to become a premium member at scriptnotes.net, where you get all those back episodes and bonus segments, like the one we're about to record on Popcorn Buckets.
Popcorn Buckets.
Curry Barker, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's a delight.
Thanks for having me. This has been so fun.
Oh, excellent.
Yay.